which it should, because we actually don't know what exactly the right approach is. And I can only mention a few and actually only discuss more or less one big approach. So we know that we have four fundamental forces around in nature, or so far we know four fundamental forces, which are electrodynamics, the strong interaction, and the weak interaction. And all these forces are quantized. And we also know that gravity is coupled to these forces, and to have it consistently, we know that that gravity also must be quantized. So we managed to quantize these other three interactions in a comparably short time compared to quantum gravity, because quantum gravity is somehow, or gravity is around for quite a long time. And one could say that so far quantum gravity research exists more or less for approximately 70 years. But we don't have a finished quantum gravity theory yet. So you could ask, what is so difficult about quantum gravity? And the reason is that gravity is not just another force. Since Einstein, we know that gravity is actually a property of space-time. And basically, if you want to have a quantum theory of gravity, we have to construct a quantum theory of space and time, or of space-time. And basically, the problem is that nobody really knows what that means. So what I'm going to talk about is basically that so far we are quite good in constructing a quantum theory of space, and we have some problems with the time issue. But already the quantum theory of space is very exciting and encouraging. And basically we have somehow to eliminate space and time as fundamental classical attributes and to replace them with something new or quantum or something entirely new, which is not even quantum. And the very hard part is that, I mean, you can replace something with something arbitrary, but you have to do it in a way such that at some point you can reconstruct your usual space-time in some kind of low energy limit. And that's the hard work you have to do. And you have to make a good guess in the first point. So we have many different approaches. Basically, different approaches to quantum gravity follow this first point to a different degree. So you can be more radical or less radical about it, in particular with respect, for instance, to the issue of time. So quantum gravity, it already gave us a new understanding of space, and it will probably give us also new models of time. But also, it might actually turn out that it will not explain all aspects of time completely, for instance, the error of time. But these are all issues where, for instance, quantum foundation comes in also understanding something, what could a quantum theory of time and of space mean. So what could the quantum gravity of space-time mean? So one aspect of space-time is actually geometry. So we want to construct somehow quantum geometry. And then since gravity is encoded in geometry, we get actually quantum theory of gravity. And geometry means that we measure distances, areas, and volumes, and so on. And these are encoded in the coordinate-dependent metric. So it's natural to try to start with a quantization of your metric variables. So the final aim is to have quantum operators or quantum measurement descriptions for something like length, areas, and volumes of certain regions or between certain events. And the second aim is that also we need some kind of dynamical description for the outcome of these measurements. And again, somehow there's an issue how to formulate really what that means, change in time in a theory where which is which should be invariant on a coordinate transformation that is also a reparametrization of time. And the approaches I want to speak about here share all the issue of background independence. And here, the approach is that we want to quantize space-time. So we really treat it as fully dynamical. And basically, the space-time background, like Minkowski, the Minkowski space-time, has to emerge dynamically in some kind of low energy limit. So one of the advantages of such an approach is that as a postfiction or as an explanation, you could get somehow an explanation why our universe, for instance, is four-dimensional, at least macroscopically, and nearly flat. Why our universe is nearly flat. So if you start to follow a background independent approach, you make your life quite difficult because you can't use many of the tools you are used to from standard quantum field theory. One example are endpoint functions, which are basically the basic tool in standard quantum field theory. And here they are very nicely defined if you have a background. Because your background defines actually what a point is and what the distance between two points is. Now imagine that somehow your quantum gravity theory gives you something like the picture, the second picture here. So it might turn out. This here. And you ask to define what the endpoint function is. And we have no, the first thing is that how do you define a point here without having any coordinates around? And the second thing is that how do you actually expect the distance in this funny? How do you expect the distance out of this funny construction? Because as we will see, somehow, for instance, loop quantum gravity gives you a picture quite similar to that. And to calculate the distance of some, say, points here, which you somehow fix with some funny description, it's encoded in a very complicated way. And even here, you might say, okay, maybe I ask, what is the distance between these two more dense blocks here? But actually, more dense might have no meaning at all, because imagine that you can stretch this piece of paper here such that it does not appear dense at all. So these are the problems that actually a point has no meaning at all, a priori, in a theory of quantum gravity. And the general problem is to define what is an observable in quantum gravity, and very many people have worked on, basically everyone who worked in quantum gravity. And Rovelli and other people actually try to define what an endpoint function might mean. And there's Hans Westmann here at the Institute and me who work on the problem of observables. So let me mention some early approaches, because we have something like 70 years of quantum gravity research. And the first one, which was followed with a bigger force, one could say, was actually the perturbative approach, where you just start to make perturbation around a fixed background, like the Minkowski background. And it provided us actually with lots of techniques which are now used in other quantum field theories, for instance, for Young-Mills theory, because gravity was more or less the first gauge theory around. So many of these techniques were actually introduced with the motivation to do quantum gravity. And really, dimensional analysis argument says that quantum gravity is quite likely non-renormalizable. And in 86, that was indeed shown by Gorov and Zagnotti that at least non-supersymmetric gravity is non-renormalizable. Yeah, so there might be some hope left for certain versions of supersymmetric gravity. And the early approaches to which could be called non-perturbative could be roughly divided into canonical quantization and path integral quantization. And also here, lots of techniques were introduced to actually quantize gravity, like Dirac quantization, because Dirac tried to quantize gravity and came up with a general description to quantize systems with symmetries like gravity. We learned a lot about the problem of time. There was lots of work done in quantum cosmology. And I want to mention also that non-perturbative path integral approaches like Gregg calculus and dynamical triangulations. And these basically showed that getting the low energy limit is a very hard business. So especially, they showed you can introduce something like the effective dimension, and it's easy to get it wrong. And basically, the art here is really to define how to define your path integrals. So these are path integral approaches. And for path integrals, you have really to define how you regularize your path integral. And that might actually change your physics completely. So for instance, this notion of effective dimensions, if you do so-called dynamical triangulations, so here we have a small cutoff, but supposed to read the same as here, Euclidean dynamical triangulations, phase one, you actually start to build up your space-time by small four-dimensional building blocks. And then basically you consider the statistical ensemble defined by your path integral, which is basically a sum over all kinds of configurations, which you get by gluing these building blocks. And you can do that Euclidean in the Euclidean realm, because in that case the path integral actually converges. And what you get there is two different phases, where one phase, if you look from very far away, is actually two-dimensional, effectively two-dimensional. So it's called the branched polymer phase. So it does not look at all like a four-dimensional space-time. And the other phase has actually effective dimension equal to infinity. Let me finish the sentence, because basically here every point is almost connected to every other point. Yeah.
What are you drawing there? What is that?
So this line, we have to imagine it as a very thin tube glued together of lots of four-dimensional building blocks. But basically, in this dimension, we have only very few in this direction. Yeah. So transversal to this line, it's only very few four-dimensional building blocks.
Okay, so you've got some sort of substance that you're treating as building up space.
Yeah.
But it's organized into these threads.
It organizes. It's not that you define to be. You don't define it to be organized in the threads, but it emerges dynamically. So you define this your basically statistical ensemble, and define a certain amplitude. The amplitude basically, you say that this is the Feynman amplitude given by the Einstein-Hilbert action. And it turns out that if you do that, you get this.
Really? Okay. So is this over time that it changes from one to two to
Yeah, it's the Euclidean, theory. So I mean, if you want to somehow imagine that time runs in this direction, and time runs in this direction.
Time of research.
So these are somehow '80s.
Are you looking at me? Early '80s.
Early '80s, yeah. So these are early '80s and produced.
Time.
Produced with computer, with Monte Carlo simulations.
So you've got little tetrahedrons or something, you're sticking them on each other on the faces?
On the little four simplices, actually.
Okay, four simplices.
Four simplices, and you glue them together at the faces or tetrahedrons.
And you have curvature sits on them somehow?
Yeah, and if you want to.
I'll ask
four dimensions, it's around the edges. So they define you a very curved, curved space-time. So here you have very high curvature. I mean, they humble up in this way. If you want to define something like a four-dimensional curvature here. So you see that generically you don't get four dimensions. But very recently, 2 years ago, one put a similar thing, that is Monte Carlo simulations in four dimensions. This is so-called causal dynamical triangulation. Causal means that you basically don't sum over all configurations which are allowed in the Euclidean theory, but you only sum over configurations where you can actually put on a Lorentzian metric. And here, basically, these configurations are just excluded because of these branching points, where you actually can't really define a Lorentzian metric. And the result is that you actually get something four-dimensional, so that has to be imagined as a four-dimensional block. And that is a very exciting result, that actually, basically, you can get a sensible low energy limit, at least somehow a four-dimensional manifold out of quantum gravity. And this was basically done by these three people, and we have Dario Benedetti and Joe Hansen here working on causal dynamical triangulations. You can ask them for further information. Yeah.
Stable is it to slight breaking of that symmetry?
Breaking.
If you break Lorentz invariance slightly and add a few non-causal things.
Mm. They have done it, so you can violate this causality condition a bit. You allow certain wormholes, and I think you have a parameter regulating that. And but it's done only in two dimensions, and then you can see how it changes from more regular to less regular geometries.
Is it gradual or is it very quick?
I think it's gradual, but I'm not sure. I mean, it's done by Loll, Soren, and Westmark. So if you want.
Okay.
Yes.
With the middle case where you've got effective dimension equal to infinity, are you saying that that's because effectively every simplex is connected to every other simplex?
There's
going to be a limit, though, because each simplex only has a finite number of faces with which to connect to other simplexes, right? So the effective dimension should be limited by the actual dimension of the simplex. Am I right, or am I not linking that term?
So somehow, there are different ways to define your configuration, and if you allow certain way, you actually get that almost every point, every vertex is connected to every other vertex. So you could say it's not a four-dimensional. I mean, you could say that you should actually make sure that they more look like four-dimensional geometries. That is, you implement some kind of so-called piecewise linear manifold conditions, and then you could probably argue that you have some kind of maximal dimension, but probably it's not done here. So this Campbell phase really means that almost every vertex is connected to every other vertex.
Okay. Right, so it sort of comes down to the definition of how you say what you mean by connected.
Yeah.
But there's no easy save along the lines you're suggesting. There's nothing like you impose some local condition and that phase turns into a nice manifold back phase.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
The only thing that's been shown to rescue it is the cause is imposing causality conditions.
So basically, that showed also for the other approaches that getting the dimension, even getting the dimension right, might be hard. And if you get it right, that is actually great success. So I'm now turning to another approach, which is canonical quantization. And that was more or less started in the 60s by DeWitt and Wiener and other people. The problem here for a long time that it turned out to be very difficult to have actually a Hilbert space representation of your metric variable in a background independent way. And some people would say even impossible, but that somehow depends on how you define impossible. And the, basically the big breakthrough came actually with the Arsteca variables. Because they allowed for a gauge theory type of formulation and we knew gauge, basically gauge theory similar to electrodynamics or Young-Mills theory. That is, the metric variables are replaced by connection A, that is similar to the electromagnetic connection. And we can integrate that along, for instance, Wilson loops. And this encodes something like the time derivative of the spatial metric. And something which is similar to the electric fields, which are actually usually called triads. And they encode the spatial metric. And basically, the operators we will define out of these things are something which is electric flux, which measures the electric flux through surfaces. And here, basically, in these variables, at least in the so-called complex version, the Hamiltonian is hugely simplified. And I can show you, basically. Here, you have the Hamiltonian, which defines you the dynamics. And at some point, it's important to have the quantization of the Hamiltonian in metric variables. And you have several difficulties here, namely, basically, you have these non-polynomial functions of the metric, and you have this hugely complicated Ricci curvature here, which is built out in a complicated way from the metric variables. And to compare it with the Hamiltonian and the complex Arsteca variables, it's just given by this term, where F is the curvature of your connection, and the E's are just the triad variables. So it's polynomial to fourth order in these complex variables. Yeah.
What are the forms of variables in terms of other quantities? I mean, do you even think of it like that? Do you treat them as independent, or are they? Do you start with them as primary, or do you?
You start with them really as primary. Okay. Primary. I mean, you have the translation of you can express the metric and that is the conjugated momentum to the metric as functions of these things.
Okay. Are those complicated functions, or are they relatively?
The E and the Q relation are easy, and the P and the A relation is more complicated.
The only reason I ask is because, you know, these are nice and simple, but maybe the complication is just removed somewhere else.
No, basically, here you treat them really as fundamental variables.
Okay. So that being simple there is good because you can quantize that.
Yeah. And that was basically the big motivation to actually jump on this or to follow this approach. And one even has one formal solution to Kodama state, which was basically never achieved in the metric variables. But it's formal. So we are missing an interpretation for the Kodama state. And it was possible to actually achieve a background-independent Hilbert space formulation, which carries basically a representation of these variables, the connection and the triad. And since we have the Hilbert space, we can discuss actually some things like spectra of spectra of geometrical operators, and they turn out to be discrete. And that's basically one of the main results of loop quantum gravity, because it gives you the hope for an ultraviolet cutoff. And basically by doing lots of other things, but by basically considering the degeneracy of the area spectrum, you can calculate black hole entropy in loop quantum gravity. So in the end, we will get something like a lattice gauge theory formulation. But the big difference is that it's a dynamical lattice. And I will explain that in the following slide. And one could say that this provides a regulator for the definition of the Hamiltonian, which was at some point defined rigorously by Tiemann.
Mm-hmm. Three parameters in this?
Yes.
Okay, what are the...
One of them, the most famous one, is the so-called Emirsi parameter.
Okay.
Which gives you at least unitary inequivalent quantizations.
Mm.
But you can fix it by considering this result and matching this black hole entropy to the to the one you want to get.
Mm-hmm.
It's a numerical factor, basically. You get the right dimension.
Does it bother you that you can get other answers for the black hole entropy?
Is it possible that you get other?
No. Does it bother you that you can get other answers?
Basically, the question is whether you find other conditions for fixing the Emirsi parameter.
That's
and,
the question.
And if it disagrees, then it's possible. So it was shown also recently that if you choose to represent these kind of variables, the representation is unique, at least kinematically. And basically, another big complex is actually that it gives you a motivation for doing spin forms and actually also better connection to the path integral approach than in the metric variables. So I won't manage anything, but so here's a very short description of the Hilbert space for loop quantum gravity. So basically, you have excitation of geometry along lines and at vertices, which we can be summarized in graphs. Basically, one can imagine that we start out with a so-called kinematical vacuum where nothing is excited. So we have no geometry at all. We don't have anything which could be a space-time manifold or something. And we also have no vacuum fluctuations actually of the geometric variables. They are just zero. and then we can use these Wilson loop operators to excite or to annihilate edges of the graph. So we get something like a dynamical graph or lattice and with spin labels. So we have labels at the edges of the graphs, and we have more complicated labels at the vertices. And these labels basically encode, for instance, the spectra of the area operator. So this J defines you what the area of this surface is, which is going through this edge. And basically, the reason for the discrete spectra of geometric operators is that these are spin labels which live in SU2. So you get here basically the Casimir for SU2 as a result for your area operator. And also for the volume. The volume, you get only non-zero volume around vertices of the graph, and the volume it's a very more complicated function of the spin labels and of the intertwiner. And if you would measure the volume, which you can't really do, but imagine that you measure the volume at a region where there is no graph, you would just get zero. So the dynamics here is defined by a Hamiltonian, and it was shown by Thomas Thiemann basically that an anomaly free UV finite quantization of the Hamiltonian is possible. What it does is basically changes the graph and the labels, so you get some kind of dynamical graph. But it's not the final result. So there are certain problems connected to this Hamiltonian. One is that there are certain ambiguities. For instance, one of that would be the J, which J label you attach to these new edges. But actually, that can be discussed or is actually addressed by, for instance, Alejandro Perez, and can be also discussed in so-called mini superspace versions of loop quantum gravity. So you can actually see what is a physically reasonable choice for this. But there's another problem with that the action for this version might actually be too local. Basically, the problem is that basically only involves one vertex, which is quite different from standard lattice gauge theories, where you usually have interactions between several vertices. But in general, it's difficult to have a consistent slicing independent evolution. I mean, that basically is the main problem for basically 50 years in quantum gravity. But it would ensure four-dimensional diffeomorphism invariants. So these locality issues can actually be addressed in the so-called master constraint program, which was initiated by Thiemann. And so we have basically to see what comes out of that. And so I wanted to explain this, but I have some time.
Program you retain if you change the Hamiltonian constraint form of the font?
Basically, all the results, because there are not so many results. concerning the Hamiltonian. I mean, the Hamiltonian so far, it is very complicated. So it is even complicated to calculate something like the matrix elements of the Hamiltonian. And the important part that it is UV finite is not changed. You change basically anomaly freeness, but the master constraint program basically is a method to somehow not discuss it at that level, but to really go for change. I mean, you actually can play around more freely with the Hamiltonian without worrying about anomalies. And the idea would be to see afterwards whether you get a sensible semi-test limit. Okay. So I will move on to spin foams. And one motivation actually came that they give you something like the time evolution of spin networks. Actually, that's very naive, but just for reason of time, I just show you here that we have something like a spin network. And we have something like the action of the Hamiltonian, which is acting here. And you get another spin network. And you connect these two spin networks, and you get something like a two-dimensional complex, which you can interpret it as something like a dual triangulation to a dual to four-dimensional triangulation. The other very important proof for spin form models are actually just by taking some version of the action. And it was shown basically that you can rewrite the gravity action as the topological BF, so-called BF theory, plus the constraint. And the importance of that result is basically that for this topological BF theory, we know exactly how to define the path integrals. So we have very nice result concerning this topological VF theory. And in some way to define these path integrals, we have in some clever way to implement this constraint. And so a spin form model, what you end up with if you do these two things, is basically consists of the following things. You have some kind of dual triangulation of your typically three or four dimensional manifold, which carry some labels. You attach amplitudes to the vertices and to the edges of your dual triangulation, and you sum over the labels. And basically, a bit depending on whether you just discuss PF theory or gravity, you also try to sum over triangulations. And the very popular spin form model was the Derek Kane model, which was proposed in 97. So here I want to mention basically the connections to Feynman diagram expansions, which can be achieved by using a tool called the group field theory. And basically, you get a Feynman diagram expansion for atoms of space-time, and the sum over diagrams actually realizes the sum over triangulations, which is important for if you really consider gravity to achieve the diffeomorphism invariance of your, or basically the invariance under choice of triangulation, because you sum over them of your path integral. And there's a very nice finiteness result also for the spin forms, basically, that this expansion can be made finite order by order in this expansion of field theory. And basically now this group field theory is actually seen as a more general framework to define background independent path integrals and as a tool for model building. Okay, as I mentioned, the hard part is really to to reconstruct the semi-classical space-time and the low energy limit. In the end, you want also to get out something like the dynamics of gravitons, whatever that might mean in your background independent theory. And in the covariant theory that is in the spin form approach, basically there's a body of work defining a background independent generalization of endpoint functions. And you can actually compute the two-point function in a certain approximation. And it turns out that it actually scales correctly with the distance for the Barrett-Kane model, at least for the so-called diagonal tensor components of your field. But it also turned out that it was not quite correct for the non-diagonal components. And that motivated lots of new models in this year, which hopefully get rid of this problem. But the problem is that these calculations are all basically lowest order in the so-called group field expansion. In the canonical approach, we have the idea to use so-called coherent states, which give you very good semi-classical limits of your connection and your triad variables. And these can be used to probe semi-classical limits of operators, like, for instance, the master constraint, which was recently done by Kiemann and Giesel. And here, the big problem is actually to have so-called dynamical semi-classical states, that is, states which are actually related to the Hamiltonian of the theory. But there's another body of work called loop quantum cosmology, which are basically where you use symmetry to drastically reduce your degrees of freedom. And in these things, you can basically solve many things and discuss the semi-classical limit, and you get results concerning singularity resolution. Now you could say that actually, all these problems, or the hard part that reconstructing the semi-classical space-time, you expect actually to have a huge graph, huge number of vertices, So it's rather an extreme many-body problem. So you should actually use statistical physics tools, and this was proposed also recently by Marco Polo, Konopkans, and Smolin. So I just have the last two slices, I think. So there are different views on whether a theory of quantum gravity without matter should actually exist, or whether a quantum theory of gravity has to include matter couplings somehow automatically. And I just want to mention that so far in loop quantum gravity at this kinematical level, we can add matter just as additional fields, and all the Hamiltonians are UV finite, at least all the matter fields of the standard model. There are other ideas which basically say that the matter degrees of freedom could arise as encoded in the topology of the graph, as braiding and knotting. And there's a very recent idea which proposes to have a unification of forces based on a connection that is BF type formulation. So I finish with my conclusions. So as I said in the beginning, despite 70 years of research, we do not have a finite quantum theory of gravity, but we have actually learned quite a lot. And for me, very exciting is that we have actually very interesting models for background independent physics. We have a good idea how finite models of quantum gravity might look like, and we understand the kinematical features of these models very well. And there are several approaches to get the low energy limit. And there's also work starting or already done on making predictions from quantum gravity or on quantum gravity from the phenomenology. And this is important because, depending on your view, experimental results might come in pretty soon or are already there in the form of the dark energy problem or the dark matter problem. So I will finish here.
Gravity as from the low energy point of view as effective field theory. There is a problem that loops are divergent and so on and so forth. But I can choose a certain observables, say anomalous magnetic moment, where the divergences are going to be just logarithmic, not quadratic. And what we know about the logarithmic divergences is that the coefficients in front of them are universal. So what I'm trying to say is that from low energy point of view, you can actually predict in one loop at least what the the coefficient of main correction to certain variables would be. It would be very nice if any of you guys could calculate and match it, because if you don't match these coefficients, it's a big problem.
Simone is extremely happy because he's trying to do that.
If I have, then I totally agree. They don't match. Even though when you try to glue with effective theory, we just had very long and interesting discussions on how this matching can really be done. It might be even tricky because, if, for instance, the final theory has some locality built in, that might not be captured by the effective theory framework. So you might get effects which might make the matching more tricky.
But I got the limit of large log.
For this particular one of logarithms,
As I understand, the basic setup is essentially some version of Hamiltonian lattice gauge theory.
And for the Hamiltonian version.
And Hamiltonian lattice gauge theory, it is very, very difficult to get exact Lorentzian values.
Yeah.
Is that a problem here?
Yes, it's part of of the slide, or actually. do you want me to change that?
No, just say.
So basically, it's to get a consistent evolution or the anomaly free evolution in. For this Hamiltonian, for this kind of lattice gauge theory. And it's very hard. It's even hard for much simpler theories like parametrized scalar field theory, where it's actually proven that you can't do that in dimension bigger than 2. But if you have this kind of consistent evolution or anomaly freeness, or you could also say, or Hooker's code that actually is a path independence of your evolution, then this path independence of your evolution will infinitesimally give you some version of Lorentz invariance. It's not quite clear whether it's exact Lorentz invariance, whether it's deformed, or whether it's likely broken. But
Why
is likely? I mean,
violations of Lorentz invariance have a way of affecting themselves into the lower
dimensions. I think I agree. If it's slightly broken, it's dead. The statement is simply that Lorentz invariance is a subclass of being able to push forward the space-like surfaces arbitrarily, so that there's local arbitrariness in how the space-time manifold is sliced, and that includes globally Lorentz invariance. And so if there's basically space-time diffeomorphism invariance, which means that there's freedom to slice space-time into space and time arbitrarily, then that includes, under the appropriate asymptotic conditions, global Lorentz invariance, a global Poincaré invariance.
I keep hearing the word
yes. Yes. Okay. And the anomaly freeness of the constraint algebra guarantees that the quantum theory implements that property.
Do you mean to say that if you had an anomaly free theory, it would be Lorentz invariant, or do you mean to say you have an anomaly free theory and it's Lorentz invariant?
I mean to say there is an anomaly free regularization of the Hamiltonian constraint, and it reproduces Lorentz invariance. Some of us are not convinced that this is the right regularization of the Hamiltonian constraint. That was a little footnote on one of our slides. But there is one which is well studied, the one of Tiemann, and that is rigorously anomaly free, and therefore that corresponds to space-time diffeomorphism invariance, and therefore with the appropriate asymptotic conditions that reproduces global Lorentz invariance. Is that okay with all the ifs?
It would be great.
It would be, yeah, but it's the most important, I mean, it's a problem which is around for 50 years. And we have actually ideas how it might work for topological field theories.
The other question I wanted to ask was about the cosmological constant. Is that a free parameter?
It depends, again, on your framework. So a canonical loop property, you could say it's a free parameter, but there are spin form models where the cosmological constant is quantized.
But it's still a free parameter.
Free parameter, but discrete values. It's not, I mean, you get actually prediction, some kind of prediction for the cosmology constant in this causal dynamical regulation approach.
You get a prediction for it.
I mean, or you get it's denormalized.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.